The world today. The time 44 days ago. The place, Houston Space Center. The voice, astronaut Virgil Grissom.
If something should happen, why, it happened. We still have to go on living every day, and we go on and continue the program.
Radio's number one award-winning program presents We Go On in Space, a special edition of The World Today. This is Tony Marvin in New York. Standing by in Mutual Space Headquarters, my colleague Phil Clark, who has covered the major space shots for the United States. Phil had the last public interviews with astronauts Grissom, White, and Chaffee. Here now, Phil Clark.
The place, Cape Kennedy, launch pad 34. The time, T-minus 10 minutes. 10 minutes and holding before the simulated liftoff of Apollo 1. 25 days before the actual launch of America's first manned moon ship. Then it happened.
At 6:31, the observers in the pad area heard a report which originated from one of the crewmen that there was a fire aboard the spacecraft. The observers report that there was what I would call a flash fire, which originated inside the cabin. This flash fire penetrated the spacecraft, apparently, and was observed to essentially surround the spacecraft for an instant, a matter of split second or very, very few seconds, as a flash of fire.
Thus, in what Apollo Program Manager Major General Samuel C. Phillips describes as a matter of split seconds, death overtook astronauts Virgil Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee. And so, in an instant, had tragedy and misfortune struck this nation's bold quest to land men on the moon in this decade. The Mutual Broadcasting System now pauses to pay tribute to three intrepid astronauts who gave their lives in man's eternal conquest of the unexplored and the unknown. We shall examine the causes of the disaster at Cape Kennedy and its effects. How deep the setback to America's space program? How long the delay in the race to the moon? The three Apollo astronauts, Grissom, White, and Chaffee, had been sealed inside their cone-shaped Apollo spacecraft for more than 3 hours. Perched high atop the 208-foot Saturn rocket that would, when fueled next month, launch them into orbit on their planned 14-day Apollo shakedown flight. There had been some minor problems with the oxygen system and with communications to and from the blockhouse, and now they were at 10 minutes and holding, but preparing to resume the countdown to simulated blastoff. Without warning, one of the astronauts cried out, "Fire in the spacecraft!" Then silence. What caused the flash fire that killed all three astronauts as they lay strapped in their seats during only a rehearsal? Major General Phillips offered this explanation.
At the time of the accident, the spacecraft atmosphere was about 16 psi pure oxygen. A fire, if there is an ignition source and combustible material in pure oxygen, this, of course, is a has a flash fire potential.
Major General Samuel C. Phillips, Apollo Program Manager at Cape Kennedy. Hours later, one reporter, George Alexander, was permitted to ride the elevator to the scene of the disaster.
The spacecraft is just a gutted, very dark gray shell. This frame is covered with ash, some very black, some gray, some white ash, and indistinguishable and unrecognizable bits and pieces of debris.
Reporter George Alexander describing the remains of the Apollo 1 spacecraft. Last month at the Houston Space Center, this Mutual correspondent talked with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Edward White, the 36-year-old Texas-born six-footer and West Pointer who in 1965 thrilled the world by becoming the first American to walk in space. Ed White was asked to describe just what he would be doing in the spaceship before liftoff.
The things that we'll be doing before liftoff, we have a whole series of tests that we go through and switch setting up on the spacecraft before launch that have to be exactly right. The big majority of them are taking care of our backup crew before we get in, but we get in considerably in advance of the time the spacecraft is launched, and we thoroughly go over the setup, and the booster itself is then prepared for flight. And I think the biggest thing that I'm going to try to keep on my mind is try to keep things off my mind at this time, because during this first part of launch, there's a lot that has to be done exactly right. And our abort modes early in the launch are the most critical ones. Everything has to be just right, and I would prefer that during this time that everything super that doesn't apply directly to the launch is out of my mind. So my biggest job would be to keep my mind right on the business. This is what we train for, and this is why we train so much, so that when the time comes for me to make certain actions, that they'll be correct.
That was astronaut Ed White. Next, in that final interview in Houston, we asked the rookie member of the first Apollo team, Roger Chaffee, the lanky, brilliant, intense Navy lieutenant commander from Grand Rapids, Michigan, what he'd be doing just before the launch.
Before the liftoff, all three of us will be quite busy making sure the cockpit is configured properly for liftoff, doing final system status checks, just making sure in general everything is set for the actual liftoff. My primary responsibilities will be monitoring the systems of the spacecraft, the electrical system, which you might say is the heart of the operation of keeping things running, monitoring the environmental control system, cabin pressure. Plus, I will have a checklist in front of me that I'm reading, and as Gus and Ed do items that are necessary for our boosted phase into orbit, I'll be making sure that everything on the checklist is accomplished and that nothing is missed.
Roger Chaffee, at 31, the youngest of the Apollo team, made no attempt to hide his enthusiasm and excitement.
Well, of course, I'm excited about being on the flight crew. I'd be that way no matter what the flight was. But I think this is a great flight. As you say, it is the first Apollo. It's a new spacecraft, a lot of new concepts, and we're the crew that's going to take it up and check it out and see how this spacecraft will operate, whether it is adequate to do what we think it needs to do to get us to the moon and back. I think it's a big flight. A lot of things have to be accomplished here, and I'm real excited about it.
Next, we asked astronaut Chaffee why he had chosen to become an astronaut.
Well, I've been in the flying business for about 9 years now, and wanted to make a career of this, and I guess the astronaut job is the top of the flying profession. If you like to fly and like to do the kind of work we're in, this is a natural place to go.
That was rookie astronaut Roger Chaffee in Houston last month. What manner of men are these astronauts? Listen now as spacewalker Ed White tells Mutual why he became an astronaut.
Well, I've been associated with flying all my life. My father was an aviator, and I grew up smelling the smell of aviation gasoline. I guess it's kind of gotten into my blood. And I became an aviator as soon as I was out of college with the Air Force, and was a fighter pilot and into flight test. And I saw the space program coming before I was qualified to be a member of it, and I decided that that was for me, and I got the qualifications, which included some additional education, some flight test experience. And when the selection time came out for the second group of astronauts, I was lucky enough to be selected.
Ed White, all his life, was a deeply religious man. He planned to take a Bible with him into space next month, and he had a special feeling for the youngsters of America who'd like to become astronauts.
I think the most important thing for a young person who wants to be an astronaut is to, the number one thing is to educate himself properly so that he can understand what's going on and be able to adequately participate and produce what's expected from him. Also, keeping himself physically fit, I think, is important also, because the education and the physical conditioning, I think, go right together with our work.
Astronaut Ed White with some advice on how to become an astronaut. Virgil Gus Grissom, the Indiana-born Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and Korean War veteran, was the shortest of the astronauts, and at 40, one of the oldest. But as a veteran of two previous space flights, Gus stood tall among this nation's 50 spacemen. We asked Gus Grissom, as command pilot of Apollo 1, why the race to the moon at $5 billion a year?
Every time I'm interviewed, I'm asked the same question, but I really don't have a good answer. I know that there are a great number of fallouts from the technology that we develop. And I know that our standard of living has been increased and a great number of things along this line happened. But I still have the feeling that the things we're going to find at the moon, the things we're going to do when we get there, are going to be a great benefit not only to us but to the whole human race.
Can we beat the Russians to the moon?
I still think we can beat them, and I think we have the capability and the technology, and I certainly intend to beat them.
Next, I asked Ed White why he thought the moon trip was necessary.
Personally, I want to take the... I'd like to be a part of the exploration from a standpoint that I feel I have the capability to do the job, and I also feel that the exploration of the moon itself is a very important step forward for man from a lot of reasons, and Gus explained one of them, which is we just can't tell right now what may be there and what we're going to learn by going there.
Ed White wasn't the only astronaut to hitch his star to the moon. Roger Chaffee, the rookie, wanted to be on that first trip, too.
Oh, I'd sure like to be on that. I think anybody wants to be on that first one. And, of course, we're all doing a job. We're working as a team, and we all realize that everybody can't be on it. I think anybody in the program would give his right arm to be on that first flight to the moon.
Roger Chaffee knew that before any of the astronauts could walk on the moon, they had to pass many, many tests.
We've got to get the LEM into flight, of course, the lunar module. We've got to do some Earth orbit work with the LEM and command module combined. This will involve rendezvous and docking and testing out both stages of the LEM engines. And we've got to evaluate the Block 2 Apollo spacecraft. What we're flying is called Block 1. We need to take a look at Block 2. There's going to be a lot of problems, a lot of operational things that have to be looked at in this area before we'll be ready for the moon.
Astronaut Roger Chaffee, like others close to America's space program, knew that the success scored so far was no cause for ho-hum complacency. He, like the others, knew full well of the enormous resources in mind and matter that had joined to carry out President Kennedy's pledge to land an American on the moon by 1970. In Houston, Dr. Joseph Shea, the man in charge of coordinating America's lunar landing program, put it this way.
There is a big difference between what we can accept in Gemini for the Earth orbital operations in terms of hardware performance or probability of the hardware working, and what we can accept for Apollo when we have to commit ourselves not to the Earth orbital operations but to the lunar missions itself. And I think it is interesting that if you looked at almost any one of the Gemini flights, and I'm not downgrading Gemini hardware at all, but if you looked at any one of those Gemini flights, you would find a number, small but significant, of problems in important systems. Even the last flight had some fuel cell problems and several thrusters out. I think you could recognize that that's acceptable for Earth orbit, where you can get back home in a relatively short period of time. In effect, push a button and you're down. But for the lunar program, when it's 3 or 4 days before you can actually get back, that class of problems, which was acceptable in Gemini, would not be acceptable in Apollo.
As Apollo coordinator, Dr. Joseph Shea said, it would require nothing less than perfection to reach the moon. And now, with last Friday's incalculable loss of the Apollo 1 team, the public's ho-hum, it looks like a piece of cake attitude, was gone. In a flash. From Cape Kennedy, Mutual's Charles Warren reports.
No one knows when the program will be resumed, but there's a feeling here that Friday's tragedy will only slow down the program for a short time. The big questions remain. How did the fire start? Why did it start? Did a spark come from an overloaded circuit? Was the spacecraft on internal or exterior power at the time of the flash? These answers one day will come from the Board of Inquiry. Charles Warren, Mutual News, Cape Kennedy. Now back to the world today in New York.
Soon, the Apollo 1 backup crew, astronauts Walter Schirra, Walter Cunningham, and Don Issel, would be on the job with a new spacecraft aiming toward the first three-man test flight in space later this year. How much later? No one yet could determine. But first, the nation would pause tomorrow to bury the first of its three space pioneers to die in action. Grissom and Chaffee at Arlington National Cemetery, Colonel White at West Point. As President Johnson said, three valiant young men have given their lives in the nation's service. We mourn this great loss, and our hearts go out to their families. In Houston, where they had lived with their proud families, the farewell had a special poignancy, as Mutual's Marvin Scott reports.
Houston has said its final goodbyes to men of courage who lived in the background of the future. The NASA Space Complex was open for business today, but the pace was slow and solemn. The offices where astronauts Grissom, White, and Chaffee had worked are empty. Papers and unanswered mail scatter their desks. From their office windows, flags at half-mast can be seen furling in the brisk wind. The hymns and sermons have just about faded into the past. Each astronaut was memorialized at separate services in churches where they had worshiped near the Houston Space Center. Virgil Grissom, America's second man in space, was remembered for his greatness and devotion to duty. Edward White, this nation's first man to walk into a new and hostile environment, was eulogized as a man who gave deeply and fully of himself. The Reverend Conrad Winburn told a capacity-filled chapel, "We have all been the recipients of a priceless and eternal treasure." He added,
"Ed's life speaks for itself and makes a eulogy unnecessary. He wrote his own eulogy in the fabric of day-to-day living. We know what Ed stood for, and it was right and good."
His words often were drowned out by the sound of three NASA jets which flew low over the church in formation, with one space to the left of the lead plane empty, a pilot salute to a fallen comrade. Three widows, each with something tragic in common, sat motionless at each of the services, Mrs. White and Chaffee dressed in black, and Mrs. Grissom in a simple rust-colored check suit. Mrs. Chaffee's tear-stained eyes were hidden behind dark glasses. The names of six astronauts, whose names already are inscribed in history, are also written in the guest books at Webster Presbyterian and Seabrook Methodist Churches. The surviving six members of the original team of astronauts attended the memorial services and will participate in tomorrow's burials. While the three valiant flyers belong to history and the world, they leave an emptiness that can never be replaced. Members of the Boy Scout troop to which Grissom's and White's sons belonged attended today's services. A friend of 16-year-old Scott Grissom took note of the personal loss in these words.
"I've been on several tours and trips with Scott, and I kind of know him very well, and he was a nice guy, and he's probably kind of bad off right now. He's going to have to live the rest of his life without a father. And I wouldn't know what that would mean, because I have a father, and he's going to live the rest of his life without a father. And it's going to be hard off on him, not having the companionship of a man."
Other fathers soon will be facing risks as they strive for unlimited goals. As for when the first manned Apollo flight will leave the pad, it's anyone's guess. And guess is all that anyone here at NASA can do at the moment. Estimates range anywhere from 3 to 9 months. Tonight, three widows are near their husbands. Tomorrow, Virgil Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee, men of science who reached for the moon, will be laid to final rest at Arlington and West Point. Marvin Scott, Mutual News, Houston.
There are some who now say that the disaster at Cape Kennedy was not worth the price, that space is not worth the conquest. The three astronauts who gave their lives in the quest believe otherwise. At their final public interview in Houston last month, I asked Roger Chaffee what his message would be if something should go wrong.
"Well, we never look for trouble, of course, and nobody wants to have any, but just by the nature of the program, it's a testing program, and we've been testing aircraft for quite a few years around the country. And I think everybody, if they stop to think of it, realizes that that possibility exists where something could go wrong, whether it be minor or major, and everybody should be, shall we say, prepared to face this possibility and know what to do in the event that it happens. I know if we have a malfunction on board, I know the crew is going to, they're going to know what action they're going to take and what's the best thing for them to do to get out of the problem."
Roger Chaffee, like his comrades, never had a chance to get out of the Apollo 1 spacecraft. After Roger Chaffee, I asked astronaut Ed White the same question. What would be his words of advice should tragedy strike?
"I think that the public as a whole has accepted the program and has accepted the possibility that there is a risk involved in it. We in the program accept this possibility also. everybody connected with the space program does everything absolutely possible to make the mission as safe as possible and as successful as possible. And we have full confidence in our teams that we work with, the manufacturers that build our equipment, so that if we do have a problem up there, it's because we've done our very best. And I think everybody has to be mature enough to accept this and realize that this nation's committed on the goal of exploring the space and exploring moon and the moon. And if we have a failure of some type, we'll reassess it, correct it, and go right on.
Finally, from veteran astronaut Virgil Grissom, one of the first to fly into space, from Gus Grissom, these words of hope and reassurance to the people of America.
I think the American public is mature enough to recognize that it's an important program, and it's a program that must go on. And if something should happen, why, well, it happened. We still have to go on living every day, and we go on and continue the program.
You have been listening to We Go On in Space, a special presentation of The World Today. This is Phil Clark of Mutual News. This has been a special edition of The World Today, We Go On in Space, a tribute to Apollo astronauts Grissom, White, and Chaffee, who lost their lives in a tragic flash fire in their spacecraft while still earthbound at Cape Kennedy. Mutual Space Programs reporter Phil Clark told the story. The World Today is produced by Mutual News in New York, utilizing all major wire services, special Mutual Overseas correspondents, and the news editors of more than 500 affiliated stations. Listen tomorrow night to The World Today, heard around the world through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio. This is Tony Marvin in New York.